Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The young anti-hero of Anthony Burgess's surreally violent 1962 novel A Clockwork Orange loves sadistic mayhem and Beethoven. Young Alex and his dandy, brutal chums speak a wild, preening slang as they rape and kill. Alex ends up brutally brainwashed in turn by the state trying to curb his ultra-violent impulses. A Clockwork Orange, the book, and the Stanley Kubrick film were nightmare classics that now look not tame, but very telling. This hour on Point, A Clockwork Orange at 50. You can join the conversation. Do you remember the first time you opened your eyes to A Clockwork Orange? Does the violence around us now feel clockwork or not? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll talk with Wired's Angela Watercutter about the new sci-fi thriller Looper, which hit theaters this past weekend. But first, A Clockwork Orange. Andrew Biswell joins us from New York City. He is director of the International Anthony Burgess Foundation, author of the biography, The Real Life of Anthony Burgess, and editor of a new 50th anniversary revised and restored text of Anthony Burgess's A Clockwork Orange. Andrew Biswell, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, the first thing I ever read of Anthony Burgess was The Long Day Wanes, about his time, I guess, as a civil servant in then British Malaya. The tone was so different, the language was so different, the subject matter was so different from A Clockwork Orange. How did he make that turn from, expat in Malaya to this in urban Britain?
Well, there are all kinds of similarities between those Malayan books and A Clockwork Orange, chief among them being that Burgess was really interested by language and the possibilities of language. Mm. So living as he did in the old colonial Malaya as an education officer, a kind of school teacher, he learned Malay to degree standard and very much made that the texture of his writing. And in the same way, some years later, when he came to write A Clockwork Orange, by which time he was living as a full-time professional writer, he visited Russia. He went to what was then Leningrad, what's now St. Petersburg, in the summer of 1961, and had learned conversational tourist Russian for the purpose of that visit. And his publisher had intended that he should write a travel book about Russia. And it was the experience of being there, speaking Russian, listening to it, seeing very violent young people running around the streets of Leningrad that persuaded him there was a novel in all this. So there are kind of continuities between the early fiction, which is much more comic in tone, and this much darker dystopia. What binds them together, I'd say, is the interest in language and the potentials of language, the kind of invented language that we find in A Clockwork Orange.
We have a 1973 recording of Anthony Burgess reading from that, right from the top of A Clockwork Orange, and you can hear right away all that slang that he concocted for this novel, Russian and Romani or Gypsy kind of slang, Cockney rhyming slang, all of it at work here. But let's just listen. Here's a minute and 30-something of Anthony Burgess reading right from the opening of A Clockwork Orange.
What's it going to be then, eh? There was me, that is Alex, and my three droogs, that is Pete, Georgie, and Dim. Dim being really Dim. And we sat in the Korova milk bar, making up our rassodox what to do with the evening. A flip, dark, chill winter bastard, though dry. The Korova milk bar was a milk plus mesto, and you may, oh my brothers, have forgotten what these mestos were like. Things changing so scorry these days, and nobody very quick to remember, newspapers not being read much neither. Well, what they sold there was milk plus something else. They had no license for selling liquor, but there was no law yet against prodding some of the new vestiges which they used to put into the old Molocco, so you could peat it with Velocet or Synthymesque or Drencrom, or one or two other vestiges which would give you a nice, quiet, or a show 15 minutes admiring Bog and all his holy angels and saints in your left shoe, with lights bursting all over your mozg. Or you could peat milk with knives in it, as we used to say, and this would sharpen you up and make you ready for a bit of dirty 20-to-1. And that was what we were peating this evening I'm starting off the story with. Our pockets were full of deng, so there was no real need, from the point of view of Krastin, any more Pretty Polly, to tolchock some old veck in an alley and vidy him swim in his blood while we counted the take-ins and divided by four, nor to do the ultra-violent on some shivering, starry, grey-haired pizza in a shop and go smecking off with the till's guts. But as they say, money isn't everything.
Anthony Burgess, 1973, reading from the top of a Clockwork Orange. You can see this needed some interpretation, and he's got droogs there and rastodocs and pockets full of ding, and of course the ultra-violent. And what has he just told us, Andrew Biswell?
He's told us that they've been out robbing. He's talking about an evening's ultra-violence. It's the teenage gang going out, shop-crasting, as they call it, stealing from shops, watching an old woman swim in her own blood. But, of course, the effect of this language, it's almost a screen, isn't it, between the actions that are described and what comes across is a kind of relish for language and maybe much, much less moving than it would be to have these things represented directly.
Sounds strange and marvelous and dandy in a way, much like the costumes that they would wear. But in the first 20 pages of this book, they strip the clothes off a schoolmaster, rip up his book, stomp on his dentures, beat the tar out of a bum. They go at a big gang fight with another gang. They steal a car. They savage the couple in the car. They break into a cottage. They gang rape the wife in that cottage. I mean, ultra-violent is the right word for their night out, Andrew.
It certainly is. It's a perp novel, Tom. I mean, it's a first-person narrative very much focalized through Alex, this teenage narrator, you know, a thug, hoodlum, call him what you will. What's remarkable is that even when you get to the end of the story, you know, there's the promise of some kind of transformation, but he never apologizes for anything that he's done. And maybe it's the first personness, it's the way that he speaks to the reader. He says, "Oh, my brothers and friends." You're almost invited to sort of join this gang and to learn its language. And in that sense, it's a very troubling book, I've always thought, and I've been reading it for more than 20 years. I think it's the deployment of that slang, that secret language, that kind of invites you in. And then, of course, you step back and you examine your reaction to what's happening, these terrible crimes which are being committed, and the relish that the gang take in carrying them out. And that's one of the ways in which I think the novel sets out to be ethically very disturbing, because it involves some kind of, you know, self-examination on the part of the reader who's enjoying all this stuff.
Because it's kind of a joyride, even though it's really horrible, troubling for the giddy ultra-violence of these very young men, Alex and his crew, but then troubling as well for how the state responds once he's picked up for murder and brought in. Remind us, because we've got listeners who may be young enough that they've never seen or read this, Andrew, and remind us what happens once he comes into the prison.
Well, it's a novel of three parts. All of the violence really happens in part one, which is, as you look back on it, it's actually much shorter than you think it is, but the content is very troubling. In part two, Alex is convicted of his crimes and goes to prison, where he's subjected, quite willingly in the first instance, to a kind of aversion therapy, this form of chemical persuasion, which is intended to cure people of their impulses to commit crimes.
That is, they give him a drug that makes him feel wretched, and then they prop his eyes open and force him to watch to his beloved Beethoven really terrible scenes of violence and mayhem.
That's exactly it. He's made to watch these films. He's shot full of this drug which makes him feel sick. And this is the real sort of sin against the person, as Burgess sees it, and Alex, his protagonist. The soundtrack is Beethoven, the music which he's always loved. So the end result of that is that whenever he thinks of violence, whenever he hears Beethoven, he is made to feel sick because of the treatment. In part three, he is released from prison and then re-meets each of the victims of his earlier crimes. And this is where the novel most resembles a parable. It's quite, mm-hmm. Implausible on the level of realism. But there he is in parts two and three of the novel being punished. And Burgess always said this was a story of crime and punishment. And I suppose implicitly what the shape of the novel as a whole is saying is that it's raising the question, does the punishment outweigh the crimes? Is the violence of the state in depriving him of his free will, is that worse than that there should be people going around being bad?
He said, I think, ultimately, Anthony Burgess, that this was his least favorite novel. Did he sicken himself with it, with this contemplation, riveting as it is?
I think he was quite sickened by the act of writing it. And there's some very personal territory being explored here. I mean, in part one of the novel, the gang break into the house of a writer who is writing a book called A Clockwork Orange. And they attack his wife. The wife is raped, in fact. And at that point, Burgess, he's dealing with an attack that had happened to his own wife during the Second World War, and trying to give it some sort of shape or order.
Yeah.
He always thought that this was, subject matter which troubled him principally, before anyone else as the author.
And soon enough, it came to trouble everybody who read or saw it in the 1971 Kubrick film Thieving Magpie. From that behind us right here, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Anthony Burgess's great and terrifying transgressive novel, A Clockwork Orange, with its ultra-violence, its vicious, giddy slang, its chipper brutality. Looking at it 50 years on, Andrew Biswell is with us from New York City today. He is editor of the 50th anniversary revised restored text of A Clockwork Orange. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. He's also author of the biography, The Real Life of Anthony Burgess. Andrew Biswell, I don't know what the book sold in its first decade. It certainly got much wider publicity, at least in this country, when the 1971 film came out. What is your insight about where most people come to know about A Clockwork Orange? Book, film, a combination?
Well, it's a curious story. I suppose these days a lot of people are aware of the film. It's very easily available on TV and other places. The DVD is very much in circulation, and the book, too, is selling hundreds and thousands of copies each year. Now, go way back, that wasn't always the case. It was a very slow burn. When A Clockwork Orange was first published in 1962, the publisher printed 4,000 copies, and they couldn't shift them. 5 years down the line, most of them were still in the warehouse. Having said that, especially when it was published by Norton in the US, it acquired a kind of underground following. You had people like William Burroughs, even Roald Dahl getting excited about it.
Yeah.
Andy Warhol made a pirate film based on A Clockwork Orange in 1965.
Vinyl,
exactly, mm-hmm. which is 6 years before Kubrick. Warhol and the Factory People made this very peculiar film. Composed of four shots. It's described as 66 minutes of torture, even by the people who like
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
A sort of classic 60s piece of underground filmmaking. So there was a sense, especially among the countercultural people, that they knew about it, but that didn't really translate into a mass audience until Kubrick came along, and thanks to, the global power of Warner Brothers, this was the point where, for the first time, Burgess found his work translated into other languages and really began to acquire that international reputation that he subsequently enjoyed.
Looking at
so it was a kind of curious relationship that he had with his own book. Mm. He didn't regard it as his best work, but he had to acknowledge it was responsible for the kind of audience that he came to command.
Which was an enormous one. And, many people look back at A Clockwork Orange. Of course, it's not the only, by no means the only dystopic work from that time. But you look at the violence which has become so common in popular media in the decades since, and it's hard to tell if he planted the seed or if he just saw it all coming. We'll look at it. Andrew Biswell, please stand by. We've got lots of callers for you. Beth in Nashville, Tennessee. Beth, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I actually was introduced to the film first. I'd never heard of it. And I was about 16 at the time, and my boyfriend introduced me to it. And we got to the rape scene, and as a big fan of horror films my entire life from a very young age, that scene, I just couldn't do it. We had to turn it off, and I tried about 10 years later to watch the film, and at the same point in the movie, I just couldn't do it. I had to turn it off. I couldn't stomach it.
What was it about if you're a horror film fan, what was it about the Burgess Kubrick treatment that made it just too much for you, Beth?
I guess it was just how they were forcing the husband to watch. And really, in horror films, I mean, you see a lot of death, but at the time, you didn't really see a lot of rape in horror films.
Mm-hmm.
That just wasn't really done. And so it was them raping her and forcing the husband to watch. It was just absolutely heartbreaking. I couldn't do it.
And if that's where you've dropped out, it means you never got to the point where they take Alex in and he is submitted to some pretty outrageous, practically torture himself. But I understand why you dropped it right there, Beth. Let me get one more, if I may. Nina in Richmond, Rhode Island. Nina, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I agree with what Beth said exactly. I saw the movie when I was just 17. I had no idea what was going to be happening, and when it got to that rape scene, I had to leave. I went into the ladies' room, and I actually got physically sick. And every time I hear the song Singing in the Rain,
yeah,
I start shaking. I hate it. Because
yeah,
that's where he was kicking the husband,
yeah,
and raping his wife. It was awful.
It is very hard to take, even now, all these years later. Nina, thanks for your call. Andrew Biswell, how do you describe what it was about the electric edge of this particular depiction of ultraviolence? I mean, just on the facts of what's going on in that cottage, it's brutal to watch. But there have been a lot of other films over the years which have had not entirely dissimilar subject matter. But the treatment somehow by Burgess Kubrick, made it, what was it that made it just so particularly impossible?
It's a very, very troubling episode from a film that is, in many ways, quite difficult to watch for all kinds of reasons. I think what people are identifying there is really the big difference between the book and the film. As I was saying earlier on, reading about these acts through the screen of an invented language is very different from, you know, watching them playing out in real time. It's a curious moment in the film because, of course, it's the only point when there isn't, other than the singing in the rain. There's no background music,
mm-hmm,
so the effect is kind of very different from the almost sort of cartoon violence that you find elsewhere with scenes speeded up or slowed down. It's almost like watching a ballet, except during this scene of the rape. What's curious about the reception of the film is that when it was first released in the 70s, people were very worried about the violent content, the gang violence. This was the thing that, more than anything else, people found sort of troubling and disturbing, that violence perpetrated by gangs of young men should be shown, and there was an anxiety that this might encourage more of it. When the film came back, it was re-released in 2000, it's the violence against women that people, you know, suddenly they noticed it was always there.
Yeah.
And I think something about the culture, in many ways, Kubrick's film, 1971, it's a kind of late 60s film, I would say, and it arrives out of this moment where screen censorship has been lifted, and suddenly it's possible to make films like Straw Dogs and Bad
mm-hmm.
Lieutenant
mm-hmm.
And The Devils by Ken Russell. So full frontal nudity hadn't really been seen before in mainstream studio films. And there was kind of an excitement on the part of directors, which we may look back on and think, you know, was this a responsible way to sort of use these things that could be shown now? What was it the right thing to do? I'm sure that a director making such a film now would think very carefully before deciding how to do it. Mary Harron, who directed American Psycho, spoken very interestingly about Kubrick's way of proceeding. I mean, she admires it as a piece of filmmaking, and she's found it very influential on her own practice. But there is a school of thought. I mean, the feminist critics of the film particularly are, you know, as who wouldn't be, kind of disturbed and very, very worried about the violence against women as it's played out in that particular scene.
So they might be worried about that. On the other hand, if you look around, and it's not exactly straw dogs, but maybe, I mean, look around. I don't know about UK television, but just even on American network television, not even cable, almost any night of the week, you can find shows these days which have the word ultra-violence would not necessarily be too extreme for what's depicted there. It is broadcast television, so not quite the same graphic detail as Kubrick, but still, you know, you can't help but wonder if some of what seemed so out there when Burgess wrote it in 1961, came out in 62, is now just part of our mainstream life, that we've accepted a version of ultra-violence as just entertainment, Andrew.
I think we've seen much worse, Tom, since the 60s or even since the 70s. I can think of, you know, particularly bloodthirsty studio films and films in which there are sort of much more gratuitous episodes of sexual violence as well. But if it's a question of the ways in which the book kind of anticipated elements of the culture, you could point to all kinds of things like the rise of punk and the sort of very violent skinhead cultures of the 1970s. And then since then, the sort of gang culture. But also, very recently in Britain, we've had riots in London and Manchester, which is Burgess's home city. And I think that's one of the things that the book identifies very accurately. And it kind of connects it with the anxiety that's there in the novel about the decline of reading and literacy and culture. Mm. I think Burgess, you know, A Clockwork Orange is one of the places where he really finds himself able to articulate that kind of apocalyptic fear that here is a society, a future society, as he's imagining it, that's always on the point of collapsing into something like anarchy, that people are not of themselves very disciplined or civilized or well-behaved. They're always kind of wanting to go out and stop smashing up shops and robbing goods and helping themselves and committing acts of sexual violence. I think this is... maybe it's a book that speaks to quite deep-seated fears, you know, held not just by the author, but more widely by the sort of community of readers.
Here's a little bit from the movie. This is where Alex is undergoing the experimental treatment in which he's forced to watch violent images after being given drugs that sicken him. He's horrified when he realizes that the researchers are playing his beloved Beethoven in the background, leading to him to feel a revulsion toward his favorite music.
Stop it! Stop it!
Sin? What's all this about sin?
That! Music won't be bad like that! It can do harm to anyone! Beethoven, just stop music!
From Stanley Kubrick's 1971 A Clockwork Orange, with us right now from New York, Andrew Lug Oldham. He's a legendary music producer, the iconic first manager of the Rolling Stones, created the band's image in producing some of their first major hits. He read Burgess's Clockwork Orange when he was a teen in the 60s, was hooked, cites the novel as one of the great influences in his life and as a major influence on the Rolling Stones' bad, bad, bad boy image. Andrew Lug Oldham, it's terrific to have you with us today. Thank you so much for joining us. How did this book work its way into your mind, into the Rolling Stones?
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you both. Around 62, end of 62, I first read this book, and it had an amazing effect on me. I think it might have been the first book that I willingly
read, and that because everything that had been they'd asked me to read at school, on principle, I refused. And also, you know, I've been listening to what we've been talking about. Mm. After the Second World War, there was this great silent subtext of, look what we did for you. But that had a desperation and a violence to it, an undercurrent of violence from World War II, the sacrifice made by our peers and our parents. Mm-hmm. And the A Clockwork Orange sort of took that and moved it into the future. It was an amazing example of what was to come, which we kind of smelt. I mean, before I was with the Rolling Stones and I did publicity for the Beatles, there was one particular scene at the Granada Bedford in England that listening to the crowd, I knew I was at the Granada Bedford, but I could hear the sound of the whole world roaring. I could hear what was to come. And A Clockwork Orange had that spellbinding, prophetic lunacy.
Wow, even in the Beatles, that is interesting. We're looking at A Clockwork Orange. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. You looked to this and looked to spread a bit of that Clockwork Orange patina, the theme, onto the Rolling Stones. But you were there to promote them. And what was the sort of revulsion attraction formula there, Andrew, that Lou Oldham, that made you think this might work
It's nothing as planned as that.
Okay.
You know, when you're young and in that Lord of the Flies period, it's a question of, this is what I'm into. You know, we were 19, 20, and 21 years old.
Yeah.
We weren't sitting there with career planning. This turns me on. This will be a way of amusing ourselves with journalists. So we will behave like hooligans. I mean, of course, 40 years later or 50 years later, it's looked upon as career planning in the same way as Elvis Presley's manager never brought Elvis to England. Later we found out it's because he didn't have a passport.
But it means there was something not just revolting but quite attractive.
Very attractive, mm-hmm. Very attractive. You know, to start with, the language was the first. It was the first time. I mean, it was fascinating. The Russian Cockney. I mean, I find the book much more fascinating than I do the film. I've always have done, because I wanted, as you may know, I wanted the Rolling Stones to be in the movie A Clockwork Orange. In fact, the movie that I'm here at the New York Film Festival promoting, Charlie Is My Darling, which I made in Ireland in 1965, was a sort of dummy run to get everybody used to the camera for an eventual film, which at that time in 65 we hoped would be A Clockwork Orange.
So do you think we headed on into that Clockwork Orange world or veered away into some other version of violent world, Andrew Lou Goldham?
How do you mean?
Well, in our reality now. Did it come to pass, or are we playing some other?
We could analyze and agree that that has happened with the loneliness and the potential violence that the technological world has put all of us into. But at the same time, if we looked back at what went on in Green Park between the two world wars and the razor blades in the cloth caps, mashing people, you know, as they went home, you know, the violence then has always been there, as you know. It just depends whether we've got it in our face on the multimedia or brought to us in a Dirk Bogarde movie.
Andrew Lou Oldham, please stand by there in New York City. Andrew Biswell as well in New York. We're talking about A Clockwork Orange at 50, a little suicide scherzo here, Beethoven's Ninth from the 1971 Kubrick movie. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Anthony Burgess's great and terrifying transgressive novel, A Clockwork Orange, with its ultra-violence, its vicious slang, its chipper brutality 50 years on. 1962 it came out, 1971 the Stanley Kubrick film. Andrew Biswell has now edited a special 50th anniversary edition of A Clockwork Orange. He joins us today from New York City. And Andrew Luke Oldham is with us as well. He was with Rolling Stone very early on. His film premiering this week at New York Film Festival, Charlie Is My Darling, about some of that life with the Stones, then life influenced by Anthony Burgess in A Clockwork Orange way back when. Here's a 1978 television interview with broadcaster Michael Parkinson, and Anthony Burgess explained one of the reasons he wrote A Clockwork Orange.
I heard talk in the 1960s of the possibility of getting these young thugs and not putting them in jail, because jails were needed for professional criminals, but rather putting them through a course of conditioning, turning them, in effect, into clockwork oranges. No longer organisms full of sweetness and colour and light like oranges, but machines. I feared this, and that's why I wrote the novel.
You feared exactly that kind of behavioral massaging of the young thugs, he says there. Let's get our listeners in New Haven, Connecticut. Charlie's calling. Charlie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to ignore the novel for a minute and talk about the film, because the first time I saw it, I was 12 years old. And, that's a little young to see that movie.
Yes, right? Yes, I'd say.
And, as such, it conditioned the way I looked at interactions with film and with violence in film in particular from that point on. For instance, when you see Alex sitting in the theater responding to the films that he's forced to watch, he's seeing these horrible, violent scenes, and he's at first smiling until the sickness takes over.
Yeah.
Later on in my life, when I saw the film, I saw myself sitting in that theater watching that very movie and feeling both the mix that you were talking about before, the revulsion and the just bizarre attraction. And I was wondering if you see anything in our society now that is kind of like the pairing of having to look at, loving to look at the most disgusting, the most violent, the most vile. We really enjoy the worst in life.
Well, let me take it to both of my guests, and Andrew Biswell, I'll bring it first to you, that revulsion-attraction duo. What about it? You hear Charlie's question. Are we still in that ratio somehow?
I think in many ways it's the subject of the novel that, yes, there are kind of awful things, there are evil things, and Burgess never shied away from using the word evil rather than bad, mm-hmm. which need to be confronted. One of his great beliefs was that art, music, literature was a way of coming to terms with these things, reconciling ourselves to them. But first, you had to confront them. And I think, one of the criticisms of Kubrick's film is not that it's too violent, but that it isn't violent enough. It shies away from some of the episodes in the book, which, as we're hearing from some of our callers, it's still a very kind of troubling and controversial thing.
Andrew Luke Oldham, why do you think you were drawn to this back then, even well before the movie came out?
I was drawn to the book. I had competing feelings about the movie. I mean, when you read a book, you can go to your masculine, feminine side, your heart or no heart side, and mm-hmm. draw your own conclusions. Whereas with Mr. Kubrick's movie, there was no such opportunity. I mean, one of the reasons I found the film difficult to take was because there was no, what I had worshipped since I was 8 years old, there was no actual charisma up there on the screen. It was, very cold and matter-of-fact above everything else, whereas the book had drawn me into, I certainly didn't recognize myself in Malcolm McDowell or Patrick McGee, but the book, Keith Richards and I were drawn to the heart of the matter. There was a heart there. We were caught in this, you've never had it so good, Harold Macmillan 50s period of, what was our future? It was a very strange time that fortunately we were saved by music. But with your other guest, Andrew, I'm drawn to the fact that when I did meet Anthony Burgess in 1973, when he came to England to go dancing with his wife, the story about the circumstances under which he wrote these three or four novels, Inside Mr. Enderby, The Wanting Scene, and A Clockwork Orange, due to having been diagnosed with cancer, is a fascinating part of the story. Because by my recall, once he got the all clear, or the all clear, or start, oh, we may have made a mistake, or whatever it was.
Yeah.
He never wrote the same way again.
Andrew Biswell, did that come in? Was it his own mortality that was driving him apart here?
I think that there had been this huge collapse in his health, which he dramatized. I mean, being a novelist, being a born storyteller, one of the stories he told about himself was that they diagnosed him with cancer, and that had been the turning point in his, you know, his literary career. I think that the truth was slightly less dramatic than as he presented it. But certainly, I mean, I think around the time that he wrote this novel, there was a kind of, on Burgess's part, a sort of dramatic change of direction in terms of the kind of novel he wanted to write and his ambition. Suddenly he's writing science fiction, suddenly he's writing books about the state of England. And I think having come back to England from the Far East where he'd been living, I think he was concerned to sort of analyze European Western society and to challenge the sort of culture of deference, which, you know, the Stones and, you know, the Teddy Boys before them, the kind of defiance within youth culture. And he found something quite sort of interesting and attractive and repulsive in all of that. I think like all of the best satirists, Burgess, you know, he's kind of repelled by what he's talking about, but not so much so that, above all, he's interested in it. There's a kind of complicated series of responses to what he's describing, a kind of imaginary, violent youth culture of the future with its own language. Linguistically, he'd always been a great sort of experimenter. And Martin Amis has said, Burgess's big legacy to other writers who came up after him was he opened up the dictionary. He kind of gave them permission to be sort of florid or extravagant or to experiment or to invent their own languages as he did in A Clockwork Orange.
Andrew Lou Goldman Oldham, how accurate or not do you think he was in terms of anticipating the degree of violence that's come into our culture, the degree of behavioral manipulation that's come in?
Well, I think that was always there. I think what's interesting about what Andrew's just quoted about what Martin Amis said is so true, because I would sit in the bathtub and compose the Rolling Stones sleeve notes completely under the influence of Anthony Burgess and the Black Bombers he was supposed to be under the influence of when he wrote the books under this either actual or dramatized death threat. Because it is interesting, if you look at after these three or four books, what did he do next for Lou Gray, Jesus of Nazareth?
Yeah, yeah. And off he goes. Andrew Biswell, how do you look at his foresight? Did we veer away in some degree from that violent youth culture he described, that heavy-handed behavioral manipulation sort of B.F. Skinner dream?
Well, I mean, Skinner was Burgess's great sort of enemy, kind of hate character. And he not necessarily read Skinner before he wrote A Clockwork Orange, but certainly when Burgess came to compose the sequel, The Clockwork Testament, in 1973, he had been reading Skinner's book Beyond Freedom and Dignity. Mm-hmm. And Skinner, famous behaviorist, psychologist, who believed in sort of building a utopia through positive reinforcement and social control. And these things to Burgess were revolting and kind of heresies. So, I mean, the question of violence, I think, isn't primarily the thing that interests him. He's more interested in the question of free will, freedom, independence. I mean, somebody once asked Burgess what his subject was as a novelist, especially with his science fiction and his dystopias. He said, I'm saying exactly what John Milton was saying in the 17th century, which is hang on to your liberties.
Did he ever say before his death in the 90s how he thought freedom, free will were holding up?
He thought that evil was always going to be there and sort of free will was the thing that was always in danger, because, you know, it's the thing that governments want to take away. And that liberties are always worth defending. So as an advocate of free speech, you know, he spoke out in favor of things like Selby's Last Exit to Brooklyn or Scorsese's Last Temptation of Christ. He was very concerned that, you know, the realm of the sayable was all the time kind of under threat or being diminished by kind of censorship or any of the restrictions on what people, you know, feel able to articulate and to express.
Well, you said plenty, almost more than we could take then or now, but what a legacy in this particular work. Andrew Biswell is editor of the 50th anniversary edition of A Clockwork Orange. Andrew Biswell, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Great pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
And with us, Andrew Lug Oldham. His Charlie Is My Darling premieres this week at the New York Film Festival. Andrew Lug Oldham, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, we'll talk to Wired's Angela Watercutter, who reviewed the new sci-fi thriller Looper, which hit theaters this past weekend. This is On Point. The sci-fi film Looper, starring Bruce Willis and Joseph Gordon-Levitt, hit theaters this last weekend. The movie, a futuristic time travel thriller, has gotten pretty good reviews, and this opening weekend it finished second at the box office, behind the animated Hotel Transylvania. Angela Watercutter is culture reporter and film critic for Wired. She reviewed the film and joins us now from San Francisco. Angela, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So, here we are, versions of one man looping across themselves in time. What'd you make of the film?
I thought it was great. I think it's such a smart take on sort of the idea of time travel. It's sort of never really been used as something that was sort of, manipulated by crime syndicates in the way that it is in this film. You know, and what happens is that in the future, time travel has been invented and then outlawed. So, criminals use it to send people back in time to be killed by these guys called loopers, who then, sort of kill the person, take them, and dispose of their bodies. But the problem is that they then have to kill themselves because the hitman, once the syndicate is done with them, needs to get rid of them. So they send them back to their earlier selves to be taken care of, as it were. And I thought it was just a really smart take on the ways that sci-fi can be used as a narrative feature in a film.
So when Joseph Gordon-Levitt, the young version, shows up and there's Bruce Willis, the older version, does Willis recognize what's going on here? What's in the cards?
Yeah, absolutely, because when you kind of go into this lifestyle, you know that eventually your number is up, as it were. So, you know, he knows that he's been sent back strictly to be taken care of. And so there's a moment when they sort of look each other in the eye and know exactly what has to happen, and I don't want to spoil the film, but it gets really interesting after that point.
Here's a scene from the film Loopers where Willis, playing old Joe, is confronted by Gordon-Levitt, playing young Joe, at a diner.
So do you know what's going to happen? You done all this already, as me?
I don't want to talk about time travel, because if we start talking about it, then we're going to be here all day talking about it, making diagrams with straws.
We both know how this has to go down. I can't let you walk away from this diner alive.
I just love that line in Looper. You know, if we start talking about time travel, we're going to be here all day talking about it. That's great. Is it made clear in physics terms how this is supposed to be happening, or is that just kept vague, Angela?
Well, it does and it doesn't. It's smart that way because it kind of accepts time travel as a sort of foregone conclusion, like it's something that has already happened, and people talk about it in very, very matter-of-fact sort of terminology. So you kind of get the idea that, you know, they have figured it out, but they don't spend a lot of time. You never, except for a brief second, even see what the time travel contraption is. So there's no DeLorean, there's no, like, TARDIS from Doctor Who. You know, there's no actual mechanism shown that presents some sort of complex gadgetry for time travel. It's accepted as a given.
So it's not Back to the Future with all the gizmology that Doc loves so much. It just happens. Do people who aren't loopers, do they know this is going on, or is it invisible to most of society in the film's storyline?
It's largely invisible, but only in the way that, you know, you and I know that criminals exist and operate and that they're drug kingpins or whatever, even if we've never met one. You know, it's sort of one of those examples of people are aware that it happens, but it's hard to track and they can't really be sure. And potentially, I guess, the law enforcement, anybody that they would want to arrest in conjunction with it, except for the actual loopers themselves who live very, very sort of underground, anybody that would be involved otherwise lives in the future. So they can't really, tracking down what is actually going on becomes very, very complex. So people do know that it exists, but it doesn't hit a sort of wide understanding or level.
So stack it up against other sci-fi time travel films for Punch, for Magnetism. How does Looper stack up?
I thought it stacked up very well. And, you know, one of my favorite ones that I watched again recently, because I kind of got into a time travel hole, if you will, was The Terminator. And, you know, The Terminator is actually really smart in that you kind of keep asking yourself all these questions about, wait, how does this work? I don't understand, you know, like, aren't they altering the future now by even having this conversation, you know? But then in the end, it explains itself. And I think Looper does the same thing in that it presents a lot of questions and seemingly answers them. But then the big question at the end, which again, I don't want to reveal because I don't want to spoil too much for listeners, but it, you know, it presents it all the way up until a point. And then it kind of leaves a big question open. So I thought it was really intelligent in the way that the things that would normally drive you crazy about a time travel movie, about how does this work and, you know, what happens. And if you go back and, you know, alter something, does that mean that you cease to exist and all those sort of things? Like, it presents them, answers them, and then kind of wraps everything up. And then at the very end, there's a surprise where you then have to kind of reach your own conclusion, which I think is smart. A lot of other time travel movies don't necessarily do that, or they present a lot of questions that don't get answered sometimes. And so it's a much more intelligent take.
And what do we learn about human nature, Angela? Are we cut out for time travel?
Probably not. I mean, we could be, but I think one of the most interesting things about it is that moment between old Joe and young Joe, where it's the moment you know is coming, which always sort of becomes a problem in time travel, because if you already know what the future is, you know, what purpose does the past have, or what purpose does the present have? So it kind of creates a sort of a psychological break for the characters, where they know how long they'll live, they know how long, you know, they'll be on this earth, and perhaps when they will die and how they will die, and yet they have to keep on going. But there's always a chance you could escape, which is, you know, you could escape your...
But it's a slim chance. Angela Watercutter, we're out of time. Can't travel. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.